This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. The worldwide art trade is worth about $30 billion a year. $30 billion. More than half of all art sales are private, often secret. But the Panama Papers enabled journalists to peek behind the curtain of this secretive world. The papers included more than 11 million documents leaked from the Panamanian law firm Mossack Fonseca. The firm created shell companies for large corporations and wealthy individuals worldwide to hide their money from governments and tax auditors. These files included many of the biggest names in the art business, including the family who owns the largest single private collection of Picassos. Joining us from NPR in New York is Jake Bernstein, a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, formerly with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, which led the Panama Papers report. His new book is called Secrecy World, Inside the Panama Papers Investigation of Illicit Money Networks and the Global Elite. Jake, welcome to 1A.
Thank you for having me, Joshua.
Also joining us from CBC Radio in Toronto is Donald Thompson, an economist with the Schulich School of Business at York University in Toronto. His books include The $12 Million Stuffed Shark, The Curious Economics of Contemporary Art.
Sure.
Donald, welcome.
Hello.
Jake, before we begin, refresh our memories about what the Panama Papers are and generally what they revealed about offshore accounts.
Sure. Well, this was, as you said, a leak of more than 11.5 million documents that was published worldwide in April 2016. Mossack Fonseca, the law firm that had its data leaked, was one of the top providers of anonymous shell companies in the world. And the leak contained more than 140 politicians from 50 countries connected to shell companies in 21 tax havens. And ended up removing from office the Prime Minister of Iceland, the President of Pakistan, a number of other prominent politicians. And it also revealed stuff like, the secret holdings of people connected to Vladimir Putin.
Why art? How does the art world factor into the Panama Papers?
Well, I mean, as you said, the art world is incredibly opaque. And one of the ways they maintain that secrecy is through using the offshore system. So tax havens, anonymous shell companies, trusts, a lot of that is run through, in the art business is used to keep the cloak of anonymity.
We mentioned the family that has the largest single collection of Picassos in private hands, the Namad family. They were mentioned in these documents. Tell us a little bit more about the Namad family.
Sure. The Namads, as you say, are one of the largest holders of Picassos among other painters. They have been active in the art market for a long time. And they have been users of this offshore system. I mean, we found documents that connected them to anonymous companies in the early 1990s. The Namads have been involved in a long-running legal battle over a specific painting called Seated Man with a Cane, which is a Modigliani. And this Modigliani, the allegation is that it was stolen by the Nazis. The Namads bought it through an auction in Christie's. And they have they've been a relative of the art dealer, the Jewish art dealer in Paris, who supposedly lost this painting when it was confiscated by the Nazis, has been suing to try to get it back. One of the defenses of the Namads was that they did not actually own the painting. Instead, it belonged to a Panamanian shell company. And what the Panama paper showed was that the Namads owned and controlled that company. And after the publication of the stories, a New York judge swept aside the Namad's defense along those lines.
We should be clear, Jake, that what the Panama Papers revealed was not necessarily that all of this activity was inherently illegal. In fact, as I recall, that's part of the outrage of the Panama Papers, is that a lot of what happened, depending on the circumstances and the countries involved, was actually within the law.
You're absolutely right. And in fact, there's this wonderful document, this email that we found in the files, where one of the top lawyers at Mossack Fonseca says, candidly, that 95% of our business is to help our clients legally avoid taxes. Now, you can quibble with the percentage, and a lot of what is legal tax avoidance is legal because authorities haven't really looked at it.
So the issue is not so much that they're breaking the law, it's just that they're being kind of slimy in their dealings around the world.
Yes, I mean, there's, you know, there's stuff that is morally questionable but perfectly legal, and there's a lot of gray area, and that is exploited because people use multiple layers to hide their activities. They use trusts, they use companies, they use foundations, multiple jurisdictions. You might have a trust in Jersey and a Panamanian company and a foundation somewhere else in Liechtenstein, for example. And so you combine all that stuff, and it's just layer upon layer of secrecy. It's almost impossible to find out what you're actually doing and whether, in fact, it's legal or not.
Don Thompson, let me come to you. The Nemoud family stored its art in what's called a free port in Geneva, Switzerland. What is a free port?
Yeah, they're a good example. They have been reported as having 4,500 artworks, worth about $3 billion stored in the Geneva Freeport. A freeport is a warehouse. There are about 20 major ones around the year, around the world, in Geneva, Luxembourg, Singapore, Beijing, and so on. And they're at airports, but they're extraterritorial. They're not within the country in which they sit. That means that if you offload paintings at the Geneva Freeport, the plane lands, you take the paintings into the warehouse, you put them in your locker, you get back in the plane and take off. You have never technically been in Switzerland. You have never gone, you've never, your presence isn't recorded. You don't go through customs, you don't show a passport. Similarly, if you want to remove things from the Freeport, same thing, there is no record of it. So they are there as storage places, but without a country.
So the significance of this for tax purposes is what? If these free ports were actually, say, we take the one in Geneva, if it was actually technically considered to be in the city of Geneva in Switzerland, I would have to pay taxes on the art if I store it there?
Well, there'd be more record of what you did and what was there. Remember, in a free port is where you store things. The second part of this system is where the money comes from and goes to. And the third part is who owns what's in the warehouse. The art may be in a warehouse in Switzerland. The ownership may be in a trust account in the Cook Islands. And the money may be coming from the British Virgin Islands. And that makes it hard to track.
Especially with places like the Cook Islands and the British Virgin Islands where these tax havens exist. So it adds an even larger level of opacity on top of everything else?
Yeah. Let me give your listeners a sense of the size of these structures. The Luxembourg Freeport is the size of 11 football fields. Singapore is 7 football fields. Beijing is 18. Geneva is 10. The value of goods in Freeports is in the hundreds of billions of dollars.
Football fields. How do the countries that harbor these free ports feel about them being in their borders? I mean, I understand perhaps Switzerland because a lot of Switzerland's economy is about financial services, but have these free ports historically been welcomed in these countries? I mean, what's the history like?
Yes, and all the ones I mentioned are currently under expansion.
So these nations know that they are there, and these are not new. I've heard, Don, that some of these free ports have existed for centuries. Probably not these exact buildings, but they've existed for quite some time.
Well, they go back hundreds of years, but they were stopping places for manufactured goods on their way in and out of a country. And originally, you paid no taxes or duties or were examined if the goods were there for less than, say, 72 hours. Now, what they did was they took away that restriction. You can store a painting in Geneva for 20 years. And as long as it doesn't enter the country of Switzerland, nobody pays any attention.
We're speaking to Donald Thompson of York University in Toronto and Jake Bernstein, the author of Secrecy World, Inside the Panama Papers Investigation of Illicit Money Networks and the Global Elite. Don Thompson, also the author of books including The $12 Million Stuffed Shark, The Curious Economics of Contemporary Art. We welcome your questions and thoughts as well, particularly on the Panama Papers, which we have discussed before on this program. You can hear our earlier conversation on the Panama Papers online at the1a.org. That's the word the, the number one, the letter A, dot org. But we welcome your questions and thoughts about this, especially perhaps if you have experience dealing in the art world as a buyer or a seller or a broker or on the auction side or as an artist, seeing the way that big money affects the art world. Share what you know about this entire network of transactions. Email us, 1A at WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Jake Bernstein, have governments tried to regulate these free ports? It seems like they're losing many billions and billions of dollars in tax revenue that I'm sure they could put to good use.
Look at the jurisdictions that offer this service. They're making money from fees associated with catering to tax evasion. So they're not really interested in cracking down on it. I mean, Luxembourg and Switzerland and some of these, and Delaware, which now has a free port, all of these places want to make themselves one-stop shopping for the uber wealthy. And so they're more interested in that than they are in collecting whatever tax revenue. Most people don't necessarily, who use the free ports, don't necessarily live in the place where the free port is. So they wouldn't really be paying taxes there anyway. So it's just a form of kind of jurisdictional arbitrage, if you will. You know, you can park your stuff in Luxembourg. You're not living in Luxembourg, but it doesn't really matter because you're not paying taxes on it.
When you say they're making money on fees, what kinds of fees would these jurisdictions be making money on?
Well, I mean, for example, there's probably some small customs fees, as you bring stuff in and out. You're certainly, paying the free port. The Geneva Freeport holds an estimated 1.2 million pieces of art, so that's a lot of vaults, and those vaults are very high end. They're fireproof and there's lots of security and so it's not exactly cheap to store stuff there, and all of that is money that then goes to Geneva, So there's lots of ways to make money off the system without actually charging taxes.
Don, is anyone able to use these free ports? I mean, it's expensive, so I assume this is not just like going to your neighborhood storage unit and buying some place to keep your Christmas lights. But, if I just wanted to walk in, nouveau riche, Joshua Johnson, and I acquired, a James Vandersea photograph or a first edition Zora Neale Hurston or whatever, and I wanted to store it in one of these things, could I just walk in off the street and say, hey, my name is Joshua Johnson, I would like you to store my art? Or do I have to know somebody to get in?
I think it might be easier if you were referred by a lawyer or by an art dealer that they knew, but the major free ports have desks at, for example, Art Basel in Miami, where they sell their services. So I think you probably could. A very small unit that might hold 10 paintings would cost you $10,000 to $12,000 a year. If you think of something that's 17 football fields in size, there are a lot of these units within the Freeport.
You mentioned,
but I think you could walk in and pay in advance and deposit your painting.
You mentioned Art Basel, the huge art marketplace that's held every year on Miami Beach. I imagine that festivals like Art Basel, Don, have had to get a little more thoughtful about how they deal with their art clients and critics and buyers and sellers in the wake of Panama Papers. Have you noticed any effect, at least in the conversations among within the art world after the Panama Papers came out?
But to go back to your earlier question as to whether governments try and regulate these, what the art world, what the Freeport world fears are that Freeports will be used for by terrorists, by drug dealers, or for storing the proceeds of crime, or for storing weapons. And they are diligent about those three things. If they can avoid terrorists and drug dealers and organized crime, then when something like the Panama Papers pops up, and it's obvious that wealthy from your country are involved, then there's a 3 to 6 month peak in attention, and then it goes away.
You mentioned drug dealers. One of our listeners, Joe, posted on our website, the1a.org, using this art market to move money sounds like money laundering to me. If drug dealers are tracked down by money laundering, then why not art dealers? I'm glad this is being put under the spotlight. It's about time. Money laundering equates to tax avoidance, which most of us cannot and should not avoid. Jake Bernstein, what about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big concern among government authorities that the art world is being used for money laundering. And it's not hard to imagine why. I mean, we're talking about a huge volume of transactions and lots of money and you know, very little, anyone tracking this or knowing who's behind it. I mean, just a huge amount of opacity. So, I mean, I think it's a real issue. There's a great story after we published our initial round of stories. I ended up talking with an art dealer who I know, and he said one of the surprising things about the Panama Papers was he suddenly realized that a number of his acquaintances had Panamanian shell companies. And each one had their own company, but they didn't know that their friends had them. And that sort of speaks to, you know, both how prevalent this is, ubiquitous, and also how much it's anonymous and secretive.
Don, I know we have to pause in just a moment, but what about that question about art being kind of a tantamount form of money laundering? Is that a fair comparison, you think?
Well, art's a store of value, and you know, depending where you live in the world and how politically stable that is, and what the chances are you might have to flee within 24 hours, you might like to have some fluid assets, and art is one of those. And so, and it's easy to move and it's easy to store, and so it is a great store of value at the high end now, but there are lots of legitimate reasons for doing that. Is tax avoidance a reason in some cases? Sure it is. But don't condemn everybody who has, art in a Freeport. There are other reasons to do it.
Audrey emailed, "The only people alarmed by the Panama Papers are middle-class suckers who have a self-defeating sense of honor. The super rich buy art and wine and haute jewelry as investments for future generations. They have no reason to be loyal to the rest of us." Suckers? Shouldn't they at least have to pay their taxes? We'll get into that in a moment. Stay close. Back now to our conversation about the secretive world of art collecting, shell companies, and tax havens, the latest revelations from the Panama Papers, with Jake Bernstein, author of the new book Secrecy World, Donald Thompson of York University's Schulich School of Business in Toronto, and with you. Still time to get in more of your questions and thoughts and stories. If you've ever encountered this aspect of the art world firsthand, we would love to hear from you. Tweet us at 1A, comment on our Facebook page, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Jake, the Russian billionaire and art collector Dmitry Rybolovyev is featured in the Panama Papers. People might recall that famous Da Vinci that sold for a record $400+ million, destroyed the record for any work of art sold at any auction ever. It was the piece Salvator Mundi by Da Vinci. Jake, what did we learn about Mr. Rybolovyev from the Panama Papers documents?
Well, what's so fascinating about that story is this Russian billionaire has been in a pitched battle with his art dealer. He's claiming that his art dealer, a man named Yves Bouvier, who actually is a principal in a number of these Freeports, overcharged him by $2 billion for a bunch of paintings that he bought over an 8-year period. $2 billion. And in fact, Bouvier and Rybolov have offshore companies that are found in the Panama Papers. So it sort of, again, speaks to how widely the system is used. But what's interesting about what we found involving Rybalov is that he had several companies with Mossack Fonseca that owned a number of paintings, Picasso, Modigliani, Van Gogh, Monet, Degas, Rothko, and also furniture and other details that his wife alleged the companies were being used to hide his assets in what turned out to be a very nasty and high-profile divorce. There was a legal wrangling that encompassed multiple countries between the billionaire and his wife. And she claimed that he was using this offshore system and buying up all this art and property to avoid paying her what she was due. In the end, a Swiss court awarded his wife, Elena, $4.5 billion. But the exact amount, I believe, is still under dispute.
So this kind of blow up is a result of a divorce settlement.
I mean, this is we found these companies and then we matched that with the reports and the filings involved in this divorce settlement. And together we sort of pieced out the full story or more of the story.
Right. And without so being, I guess without being too flip about, you know, how divorces can go sideways, it seems it's interesting that a lot of what has come forward in terms of these hidden works of art has come forward as a result because of divorce proceedings where one spouse alleges that something exists and then a court goes to track it down.
You know what's so interesting, Joshua, is that in the stories involving art that I found in the Panama Papers, they often seem to come freighted with a lot of family drama and extra baggage. You know, there's something about art. It's more than just a store of value. There's sort of emotional and historical elements that are, you know, involved in art and the history of art and actually having something, you know, of artistic value. And so it's not surprising to me that that some of this comes out in a divorce proceeding. Another case that I write about in Secrecy World involves this Spanish art billionaire named Carmen Thyssen Bornemisza. And she is involved in a nasty dispute at one point with her son, where her son believes that he deserves a certain share of the art collection that she has. And she's got it in some trusts and anonymous shell companies in the Cook Islands, among other places. So this is not uncommon, and it's not uncommon to sort of learn, get glimpses into this world when you don't have a massive leak through messy legal dramas involving families.
It is perhaps worth noting, Jake, that there is a connection between Dmitry Rybolovlev and President Trump. He sold a mansion in Florida to this Russian billionaire for $95 million. Mr. Trump had purchased the mansion a few years earlier for $40 million, so sold it to him at a profit. How significant, if at all, is this in the context of the Panama Papers?
Well, in the context of the Panama Papers, I mean, it's just sort of one more sort of element of how, you know, people like both Donald Trump and Rybolov use this secrecy world to shelter their activities. I mean, Trump ends up having more than 500 companies. He said this on the campaign trail, and more than 300 in Delaware alone. So he was a practiced user of this secrecy world. And in fact, in the Panama Papers, and I discuss this in my book Secrecy World, I found mention of more than 9 of Donald Trump's foreign business partners. So both Rybolov and Trump know this world, use this world, use this system. So in that sense, it gives us a sense of the kind of players.
And Jake, just for those people who don't really follow the financial world in the United States, why Delaware? Why is that so significant in terms of businesses and taxes and corporations and the rich?
I mean, this is one of the great ironies, Joshua, is that most people think that tax havens are, you know, happening in some sunny island with palm trees and tropical breezes. And in fact, one of the biggest tax havens in the world is the United States. And it is driven largely by Delaware, but also by Wyoming and Nevada. And these jurisdictions are kicking out, you know, hundreds of thousands of companies. Delaware makes $1 billion a year from its public registry. That's just the fees on the companies it's minting for people. And in fact, the State Department and the Treasury Department have complained that Delaware is being used by Russian mafia and transnational gangs and others, that they're getting these companies and then laundering money and doing other things. But they have been impotent in being able to force Delaware to put more transparency into what they're doing.
Scott in Grand Rapids, Michigan emailed, "The super rich hoarding money out of the public eye is detrimental and should be criminal." Kevin emailed, "Wow, freeports have existed for hundreds of years. The rich literally have different rules to play by, don't they?" But Audrey emailed, "The only people alarmed by the Panama Papers are middle-class suckers who have a self-defeating sense of honor. The super rich buy art and wine and haute jewelry as investments for future generations. They have no reason to be loyal to the rest of us." Don Thompson, what do you think? How shocked, or perhaps not surprised, should we be by the revelations of all this? The Panama Papers, the art world, these tax havens. Should this inflame our sense of moral outrage, or should we just kind of know by now that this is the way the world works when you're super rich?
Well, everyone knew that tax havens existed. Everyone knew that places like the Cook Islands existed, and that wire transfers moved money around in a fairly secret way. I think Panama Papers indicated that there were a lot more people involved than we had probably thought. But it didn't. I don't know that it. And it gave us the name of some politicians. And as Jake mentioned, several of whom have resigned. But other than that, I don't think that what it revealed was unknown up to that. Maybe just the scale of it was new.
I wonder, maybe to follow on that, Mimi emailed, "How do these tax havens affect the personal power of an average Joe like me? Why should I care about the secret world?" Don, do these kinds of tax havens really affect the average person?
They, to whatever extent they limit tax receipts, sure, they reduce the amount of medical care you get, the amount of education your children get, the quality of your roads.
Go ahead, Jake.
And of course, the central issue of the last couple of years, income inequality, the fact that 1% of the population, the world's population, now owns 50% of the assets, is directly related to the inability to pay taxes, to collect taxes.
Right. Jake?
I would just chime in. I mean, Don is absolutely right that governments claiming poverty when they're not collecting taxes because people are using this system is a big something that affects us all. But also, if you live in a major city in our country, if you live in New York or Miami or Los Angeles or San Antonio or Honolulu, foreigners are using anonymous shell companies to buy houses and apartments. And oftentimes, they're not living there. It's just a way to park cash. According to the Treasury Department, a large number of cash transactions for these properties on the high end have generated suspicious activity reports, which means that there's red flags that it might be money laundering or bribery or the proceeds of a crime. But the impact is that it drives up property prices for the people who live there. So if you're a millennial or someone starting out or someone who just, is a middle class person who wants to buy an apartment or a house in one of these cities and you're finding that it's just too expensive, well, part of the reason is because of this system.
Munsing Law tweeted, "Has anyone determined," and Don, I wonder if maybe you might take this one, "has anyone determined at what point a person with an offshore art holding is spending more in shell companies and layers of sketchy paper and is only saving a small percent of their income in taxes? Is it that the super rich don't want to pay any tax at all? Don, is there a point at which it's just not worth it to jump through all these hoops?"
Well, obviously, if you're working with $50,000 works of art, it's not worth doing. If you're working with $50 million works of art, it probably is worth doing. Think of an oligarch from Eastern Europe who might just have to leave the country on short notice and wants to have some assets in the West. Art is a pretty good place to do it. Buying condos in New York City is a pretty good place to do it. And we welcome people investing in our cities, in our country. So there are two sides to this. Yes, they're buying real estate. Yes, they're creating jobs. And yes, they're driving up prices. It's not one-sided. And a lot of it's not illegal. It may be illegal in their home countries. It is not illegal here. So it's a lot more opaque.
You mentioned
a lot more fuzzy than you would think.
You mentioned the difference between a $50,000 worth of art, work of art, and a $50 million work of art. I wonder also what role maybe the art houses hold. I mean, here is what it sounded like in Christie's last November when that Da Vinci, Salvatore Mundi, sold for $450.3 million with fees included. Here were the final moments.
370 million. At $370 million.
Leonardo Salvatore Mundi selling here at Christie's. $400 million is the bid, and the piece is sold.
That was the winning moment at Christie's. Don, how much are the big auction houses, Christie's, Sotheby's, and others, stepping up to deal with some of the concerns around this money? Do they feel this at all, or are they kind of insulated from all of this controversy?
Well, apropos what you just played, if you ever want an example of how much money there is in the world, the last jump bid on that Leonardo was $30 million.
Right.
It went, the previous bid was $370 and it went to $400 million. $30 million as a jump bid to deter others. The winner was a Saudi. The art is going to the Emirates. The underbidder was almost certainly the from Qatar, who wanted it for their new museum. The auction houses very often don't want to know who buyers are, because if you don't know, nobody can ask you. So a lot of transactions are done through lawyers in Switzerland, through dealers who bid but aren't told who the buyer is, with funds coming from overseas. So the auction houses don't necessarily know where the work came from, don't necessarily know where it's going, and don't necessarily want to.
We would be remiss before our time is up if we didn't ask you about the Qatar Museums Authority, Don. I believe you have said that the most important person in the world of contemporary art is the head of the Qatar Museums Authority. Why is that?
Sheikha Amayasa Al Thani of Qatar is considered to be the most influential buyer. She's the sister of the emir. Her father's the former emir. She manages a buying budget of about $1 billion a year to buy art for new museums that are either there or under construction. To put $1 billion a year in context, MoMA in New York has an annual acquisition budget of about $35 million. The Metropolitan has about $40 million. The Pompidou Center in Paris has $4 million. And that makes Sheikha Amayasa a very, very important player in the art world.
Jake, we're low on time, but before we end our conversation, I wonder what is the next step in this process? It seemed like the Panama Papers did cause some real political fallout. Some lawmakers, some politicians lost their jobs. It's caused some more inquiry into the way that the financial system works around the world. But we are talking about the super rich here. How much accountability, how much change do we really expect to come from some of these revelations before we're out of time?
Well, on a micro level, it's still going on, right? Prosecutors and tax authorities worldwide are still pawing through these documents and making cases. I mean, to date, Worldwide, tax authorities have collected $500 million from the Panama Papers. So it's still very much a live issue. But I think the bigger thing is it shows us a macro view of this system and how it operates and how it evolves. I mean, it's almost like a living organism. You know, it's constantly moving around. And so we're going to continue to see repercussions both in how it reacts to these, how the system reacts to these new revelations and this new attention, but also, you know, from direct, you know, issues involving what was found in these documents.
That's Jake Bernstein, author of the new book Secrecy World, and Donald Thompson of the York University Schulich School of Business. Gentlemen, thanks very much for talking to us. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.